It's a funny business. Ask Ted Ray.
Will Fife was a darling man. Mm. I remember when Will and I were in the Isle of Man, my wife was about 8.5 months pregnant, and Will, who was a great fisherman, said to me, "What do you think it's going to be? Do you think it's going to be a wee boy or a wee girl?" And I said, "Oh, Will, it's going to be a boy." He said, "I think it'll be a girl." I said, "No, it's going to be a boy." He said, "Well, will you send me a telegram and let me know what it is?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I hope it's a child." And he walked out of the dressing room. Well, about 3 weeks later, Sybil gave birth to Robin. And knowing Will's love of angling, I sent him a telegram. And I put, "Mrs. Ray landed male trout, 7.5 pounds, this morning." And within an hour, a telegram came back. "Everything under 8 pounds must be thrown back."
Oh.
Isn't it terrific? Isn't that super duper?
I must tell you that there's a notice above the Ted Ray doorbell. It reads, "Please note, unless you have an appointment, you had better have a good reason for ringing this bell." Well, all I can say is I'm glad I had an appointment, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to the result, as Ted Ray hopefully proves it's a funny business.
Well, you see, Michael, it all began like this. I was the son of a comedian. My father was a failed comedian. He never got the breaks. And there are many people like that. I know, I've often thought that there's so many funny men who never got the chance to prove it. There's many a man standing behind a counter who should be standing behind the footlights.
Mm.
But it all began, as I say, as a son of a comedian. And I went to school, and I tried to make the boys laugh, the other boys laugh. I wanted to hear them laughing. It was some kind of inner compulsion that caused me to hear other boys laugh at my jokes.
Mm.
And I used to get into terrible trouble, Mike. I really did. I used to say things under my breath, like, "Look at that master there, Swinstead. Look at his fingers. He smokes tobacco. He ought to give it up in the nicotine." These terrible jokes, and these boys would laugh. And the master would hear them laughing, and he'd come out and look at these boys and said, "Who is making you laugh?" And then they'd all look at me.
Yeah.
So I was the fall guy.
Right.
And I used to get the cane, and quite a lot. I can show you the marks. But one day, yes, later. One day we were in the woodwork class, and I was standing next to a boy, believe it or not, whose name was Carpenter. And now it goes against the grain, but we were laughing about, and the master came over, and he said to Carpenter, "All right, I know who's doing it. He's making you laugh. Now you're both going to get the cane." Now, this kid, Carpenter, was terrified. So I said, "Well, I was used to it. You know, I really was. In fact, I was beginning to enjoy it." Now, Carpenter never had the cane before, so I said, "Put a piece of tin down your bags." And the idiot did. And when the headmaster got to work with his cane, all the other kids thought the bell had gone and we all went home. Well, excuse me, I must get a room tonight. But I left school and by mutual consent. And I remember the headmaster walked to the gate with me and he said, "I'm very glad to have turned out a boy like you. I wish I thought it sooner." So I then learned the violin. But anyway, in later years, I was very grateful for this musical training. I met a fellow one day who was in a dance band. And I don't know whether you remember, Michael, perhaps you before your time, in those days, there was a lot of little dance bands and little hops and halls up and down the country. And around Liverpool, I got into this dance band, playing the violin, and we called ourselves the Fatal Five. One night, a man in the hall came up to me and he said, "Would you like to go into a review?" So I pleaded with my mother to let me go, and fortunately she said yes. So I went into this review, which was called On the Panel, and I won't mention the name of the comedian, Tubby Turner, but we went up to Sunderland. And Tubby was a very broad Lancastrian comedian, so they couldn't understand each other, and Tubby got the bird. And he flatly refused to go on again. and he nailed himself up in his dressing room. So, with no fear at all, not realizing what I was letting myself in for, I said, I'll go on. I can tell jokes. And I went on. Now, if you think that this was the story of the overnight success, A Star Is Born, you have never been more wrong in your life, Michael. Because what they did to Tommy Turner was a vote of thanks compared to what they did to me. They gave it to me in unison. Those who were in. And one night, a fellow actually threw a tomato at me. And I said, thank you for taking it out of the tin. Which was the first ad-lib I ever cracked in my life. But we got to the end of the week, and I'd done 11 performances. I'd stuck it. And strangely enough, in a masochistic way, I'd enjoyed it.
It's like the caning, too.
It was almost like the caning. I was beginning to like it, and I thought, this is great, this is what I want to do. And I thought, this is my destiny. So they all got together, and the manager said, well, we're going to have a whip round. And he gave me a little black kiss. And I thought it was a watch, and I opened it. It wasn't a watch. It was, you'll never believe it, it was a silver compass. Well, I didn't know the time, but at least I knew where I was going.
There's no business like, no business like, no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you have that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow.
Well, the one thing I realized at this time, I felt I had the wrong name. A name is a very important thing.
Yes.
My name, actually, at this time, was Nedlow. And the reason I got my name like that was because it was my own name, my own surname, O-L-D-E-N, reversed, Nedlow. And I became a gypsy violinist. I tried everything. But there weren't many jokes about gypsies, so I thought I'll have to change my costume and find another name. So, believe it or not, I call myself Hugh Meek, the unique comedian. The bill matter was also very important. I remember a man called Percy Honry, who used to play the concertina, right. And his name said, Percy Honry, the concertina turn. Very clever. Another act was a tumbling act, and they had underneath their name Flip and Flop, Why Go to Niagara to See the Falls? Very clever.
Right.
One of the funniest ones I ever knew was a fellow called Alf Thomas, and he was called Mrs. Thomas's favourite husband, which killed me.
Lovely.
It was rather daring in those days, too, yes. To use a gag like that as bill matter. But we were on the bill together, Alf Thomas and I, at a little theatre in Liverpool called The Lyric. It was a fourth-rate music hall. But Alf Thomas said to me, when I came off, you've got it. I said, have I? He said, yes. I said, oh, I'm glad. What is it? He said, you've got the art of talking, the patter. He said, I've been in this business 20 years, but I can't talk like you do. Would you like to go to London? I said, you're mad. He said, no. I can fix it, I think. I said, well, how? He said, well, there's a music hall in London, in the East End of London, in Shoreditch. And if I write to the manager, I think I can get you a trial date. A kind of prehistoric opportunity knocks, if you like.
Mm.
But this was for money. He said, ask him for 15 quid. You won't get it, he said, but take 5. And this is what happened. So I got a letter back from Mr. Freeman saying that I was on for 5 quid. And I went from Liverpool to London by motor bus, or a charabanc, as they called them in those days. And that took care of the 5 quid. And I went along to this place in Shoreditch, the Empire Music Hall, the London Music Hall, rather, Shoreditch. And I was on about fourth turn in the second half of the programme. And I walked on with no fear at all. I had no fear of audiences, no nerves, never. I was a bit of a sassy kid, you know, but I was a gunner. And I walked on, I put my fiddle under my chin, and I said, this joint can be emptied in 3 minutes. And the audience fell apart. That laughter was music to my ears. That this laugh, I thought, oh, marvellous. Well, at least I knew there was nobody in from Sunderland. Well, I didn't realise at the time that in the audience were quite a few agents. And one of these agents was a little cockney called George Barclay. who lived in Brixton Hill, and he sent for me to come up to his office. I went up the next day, and he said, we'll have to change your name, son. We'll have to change it. Well, I'd gone back to the name of Nedlow.
A terrible name, isn't it?
Nedlow, isn't it? It sounds like a cleaning fluid. So, I could have called myself Charlie Harpick, I suppose. But that's by the way. Anyway, he said to me, what do you think? Now, well, we want a new name, because I've got all these contracts here, and I couldn't believe it. They were all lying there in front of me. 15 quid, 20 quid, 25 quid. This was money in those days. I thought I was dreaming. So I took out from my pocket a little diary, and I began to look down the list of sportsmen. He said, we've got to get a name, son, quickly. So I came to the list of golfers. And I looked down. I said, Bobby Jones? He said, no. I said, Harry Barden? He said, no. I said, Ted Ray? And he stopped in his tracks. He looked at me. He said, that's it, Ted Ray. Come on, sign it here. And for the first time in my life, I wrote Ted Ray. Incidentally, that clock on the mantelpiece,
yeah,
has got on it, presented to Ted Ray on winning the American Open Championship in 1920. I bought it from his widow, and there it is to this day. It's been a very lucky name for me, Ted Ray. I never met him. I wish I had, but I took up golf, and I've had great enjoyment from golf ever since. Had a lot of fun, you know, signing the visitor's book, Ted Ray, and they said, oh, it's an imposter, you know. He's a big fellow with a big black moustache.
You are my lucky star. I saw you from afar. Two lovely eyes at me, they were gleaming.
Around about this time, there were a lot of comedians who played the violin.
Yes.
And the reason why they did this was because if they couldn't sing a song, they had to have some means of getting off with dignity.
Yes.
You can't just finish,
no.
Tell your stories and leave there with your face hanging out. You had to be able to play the fiddle, especially with a hard audience.
Yeah.
At least it got you off the stage.
Yes.
There was Vic Oliver, Stanelli, Jack Benny, Jimmy Wheeler, and they've all gone now. Isn't that sad?
Mm.
I bet they're all up there arguing as to who's on first. But God bless them. And Vic Oliver, I remember Vic later. I must tell you about this, a little story about Vic. It's perfectly true. He used to do reviews in the West End of London, and then I used to tour them. He did a show called Black Velvet, and I took that round the country for 2 years afterwards. And then he did a show called Get a Load of This. It was a comedy, a melodrama, written by James Hadley Chase. And I toured that. And then they came to Vic one day, and they brought him another show. And he read the script, and he said, oh, it's no good. Oh, Ted Ray would never tour it.
You hear the story about all the trees in the woods had a big party, and a little dog strolled through the woods, and one of the trees said, come here, little puppy, join the party, have one on me. And the little devil... And little puppy said, no, thanks, I can't. I just had one on the house. That's one joke you won't hear on the wireless.
Poor old Vic. He died in his dressing room in Johannesburg. Still with his makeup on.
Did he?
He did, yeah. But he was a very good man. Now, Stanelli, he was a funny man. He was a good fiddle player.
Mm.
Stan, I think he was really the most competent fiddle player of us all, really. We could just play simple tunes, anything to get off. But a very funny story about Stanelli. He was in a traffic jam one day, and there were all these motor horns blowing. Beep, 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 beep. And he suddenly got a brilliant idea. And he formed the Hornkestra. He got all these battery-operated horns and bulb horns and taxi driver's horns and things and formed his own orchestra. It was a brilliant idea.
Beep, 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 beep
the most forthright of these fiddle-playing comics was Dear Jimmy Wheeler.
Indeed.
You only had to look at Jimmy to laugh.
Yes.
I think he was the last of the red-nosed comics, Jimmy was.
So, yes.
I mean, he'd say stuff like, "Went to the fish and chip shop last night. So you got any chips?" The fella said, "Plenty." I said, "It's your own fault for cooking so many. Had a marvellous sense of humour. Poured hot fat all over my head." I love Jimmy. Now, Jimmy went to the Hoban Empire, and he could only play one tune on the violin, and it was called Mistakes. "We make mistakes when we worry," you know.
Yes.
And the manager, Mr. Adams, sent for Jimmy after the rehearsal, and he said, "Jim, could I have a word with you?" He said, "Yeah, what is it, mate?" Adams said, "Jimmy, it's about your violin solo." He said, "Yeah? Well, don't you like mistakes?" He said, "Yes, I like mistakes, but, Jimmy, you've played it for 20 years. Can't you give us something else, anything?" He said, "Well, what would you like, fascination?" He said, "Yes, something like that." So Jimmy, very disgruntled, he said, "All right." He said, "I'll play fascination, but don't blame me if it sounds like mistakes." Isn't that a killer?
"And I've got a job on the railway as an assistant archer." "Well, you know what an assistant archer is, don't you?" "Well, you know the fellow that taps the wheels? Well, I help him listen." "You know, the funny thing is we sent 6 trains to the repair shed before we found out it was the hammer that was cracked." "I only let you luck.
Well, I had this violin. Will you pass me that violin, Michael? Open the case there, that's right. Thank you very much. That's right. There's 2 of them in there, you know. I keep on hoping they'll breed, but I think they're both males. Don't touch that, it's rather highly strung. This is the kind of thing I used to do. I used to play a bit of a tune and then crack a little gag like this. Did you hear about the bumblebee who broke his leg? He fell off his honey. And so on, so on, so on, so on, so forth. Okay. It was great. And then you crack these little jokes and get off the stage. And so it was great fun. And I went on playing the Palladium 4 or 5 times a year and touring the country and doing these reviews. But a very momentous thing was to happen in my life. I was booked to play the Palladium with a great American artist, and his name was Danny Kaye.
"Spread your loving arms way out in space. You do the eagle rock with such style and grace. You put your left foot out and then you bring it back. That's what I call balling the jack."
Danny Kaye was a tremendous artist, possibly, I think, the most consummate, perfect variety performer I ever saw. And I was quite a success, too, because I was sitting in my dressing room on that Monday night in 1948. And I thought to myself, "Who's this fellow, Danny Kaye? I'm on before him. I'm going to show them." And I came out there. And later, a friend of mine said to me, "When you took your first step on that stage, I knew you meant business." And I did. And I went out there and I killed them. Those I didn't kill, I fractured. I really did I had 15 minutes of belting stuff that I'd written and my fiddle and a couple of numbers I sang, parodies, and I came off there and I really hit them hard. And Danny came on, but of course he was marvellous. But the papers came out and compared us. They put, "Who is better, Kaye or Ray?" But it was great for me. And yet, you see, that could have antagonized this great star. But we were great, great chums. Well, of course, this got me very well known before I'd done any radio. And then in 1949, I'd been up in Blackpool the previous year doing a summer show with Henry Hall.
Yes.
At the Grand Theatre Blackpool. And Henry was doing his guest night from the Jubilee Theatre in Blackpool, and I was comparing the show. And it was being produced by a very fine producer from the BBC, a fellow named George Innes. He started the Black and White Minstrels, and you know what a marvellous success that was.
Yes.
Poor George, he was a lovely man. And he said to me, "Have you ever thought of doing a radio series?" I said, "Constantly." He said, well, what can I suggest to the BBC? What sort of a fellow do you want to be? Do you want to be a man about town, a detective, what kind of situation? I said, well, I'd like to be the average man. The average man and wife, living in Cranley Gardens, somewhere in the suburbs, holding up a mirror to life, and doing things that people did.
That we could identify with.
But that's right, self-identification, you see. And they called it Raise a Laugh.
BBC presents Raise a Laugh with Kitty Blewett, Kenneth Connor, Laidman Brown, Pat Coombs, and starring Ted Ray.
But it was a marvellous show, and it was live.
It was live, Ted?
And it used to be, I think it had two repeats at home. It had a repeat on the home service, a repeat on the light, and dozens of overseas repeats. I remember arriving in Egypt. And this fellow looked at me, he had a fez, like a dusky Tommy Cooper, you know. And he looked at me, and he listened, he said, your voice, he spoke some English, he said, your voice, I know, your voice, raise a laugh, raise a laugh. Now that's what radio can do for you. Never mind being seen, he knew the voice. That was marvellous, wasn't it?
I have a slice of toast, please, Kitty?
No, Ted, I'm sorry, it's impossible.
Kitty, this is hubby talking.
Mm-hmm.
And if it isn't, how dare you entertain men friends to breakfast in dressing gowns?
What?
I demand a piece of toast forthwith.
All right, Ted, here's the toasting fork and a slice of bread. Now, all you got to do is order some coal and get a nice fire going in the dining room there. Go ahead.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I made a perfectly reasonable request. I asked for a slice of toast. Is that too much? But I might have known. The moment of truth. We've reached the crossroads of our marriage. We can either take the tenuous path that leads to a breakup or attempt some sort of reconciliation. May I please have a slice of toast?
I have told you, Ted, it's impossible, and there's a perfectly good reason.
What's that?
That so-called electric toaster, along with a few other things, hasn't been working now for days. And what's more, you haven't lifted one little finger to put them right.
That's it, then, eh? I'm no longer the toastmaster. We've come to the crust. I'm in the crux of the matter. Kitty, let me put you in the picture, dear.
Do that.
I slave in an office from, I fluctuate a bit.
Sure.
But I slave in an office.
Yeah.
And you know why I slave in an office? To provide bread for those dependent upon me.
Mm-hmm.
And having provided it, what do I find? No one will toast it for me.
A lot of American comedians I love, too, all great American comics. Jimmy Durante.
Yes.
He was a wonderful man.
Performer.
Oh. I remember going to Las Vegas. My wife and I took a holiday, and I went over to see him, and he made a big fuss of me. And he went down for about an hour and a half. And I was very annoyed. I said to my wife, he hasn't sung Inka Dinka Doo. She said, no, I wonder why. He'd sung everything else. But at the end of nearly 2 hours on the stage, he came forward with a little soft music behind him. And he looked at this audience and he said, and this was the art of the man, this was the great artistry of the man. He said, well, folks, I've got to leave you now. But I want to give you one word of advice. He said, say it with flowers, say it with candy, say it with gin, and say it with brandy. Say it, my friends, with whatever you think. But whatever you do, never say it with ink. Ka-dink-a-doo. Standing ovation. The hair on my neck stood right out. I went cold. Supreme artistry. He knew that everybody in that audience was waiting for that song. But it wasn't that great.
A-dink-a-dee, a-dink-a-doo, a-dink-a-dee. Oh, what a tune for crooning.
That's enough, fellas, I'll take it alone. A-dink-a-dee, a-dink-a-doo. You know, boys, last week I sang for the Sultan of Fashion. And the Sultan offered me his harem of 500 beautiful wives. But I turned them down. Because when I get up every morning, who wants to find 1,000 stockings hanging in the bathroom? Not Durante.
One of the great qualities about being a stand-up comic is that most of them have been able to laugh at their own failures. Now, there was a comic called Scott Saunders. He wasn't a Scot. He came from Birmingham.
What was his song, Ted?
That was rolling round the world, waiting for the sunshine that never seemed to come my way. Yes. Well, he went to Dundee. He was top of the bill. Now, they've always been a bit parochial in Scotland. They've always liked their own.
Yeah.
And when they saw Scott Sanders, they thought this is going to be a Scotsman. But he came on and just had an ordinary voice, an English voice, you see. And they didn't like him very much, and they were very quiet. No laughs, nothing. And he stood it, and on the Saturday morning, he went into a hairdresser's to have a haircut. And he fell asleep. And when the fellow had cut his hair, he'd taken the clippers right up to the top. It looked like something out of Cheech and Chow. And Scott's furious. He looked at this, and he could, of course, there was no way of putting it back. He went to the theatre that night. He did his two shows, and he came out for his final curtain. And he said to the audience, they had a deep actor's voice, "Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for the way you've received me this week. You haven't been demonstrative, but then maybe I wasn't as funny as you thought I was going to be. But honestly," he turned his back to the audience, "do you call that a bloody haircut?" Now, that's a sense of humour, isn't it?
Ted, thank you very much for being my guest on the programme, and thank you for your hospitality in your lovely house.
Thank you, Michael. It's very nice to have you here. Glad you came.
I've enjoyed listening to your stories.
It's been marvellous. I'm always trying to be original, and as I often say, it's easy enough to sit in the audience and knock off people's jokes, but there's always something nice about creating your own.
Indeed.
And it's always been my belief that it's a wise crack that knows its own father.
Lovely. Well, on that one, we'll leave Ted Ray, and hope you join me again the same time next week. Until then, Mike Craig saying goodbye.